as we move forward with AI and automation, it's more of a black box and maybe harder to explain and understand what decisions are being made potentially. I think that's putting more emphasis on people to say, look, don't take the technology for granted that it's always right.
In May 2024, the UK enacted a law quashing the convictions of hundreds of sub-postmasters after many were wrongfully prosecuted due to errors in the software Horizon, used by their employer, the Post Office. This scandal, alongside other recent controversies, has placed the spotlight on IT outsourcing projects and the potential pitfalls, both for buyers and for the public. Paul Chapman is a senior fellow in operations management at the Said Business School of the University of Oxford and vice president of the Association for Project Management. He discusses the risks for buyers inherent in outsourcing today, as well as strategies to mitigate these.
Because of the embedded technology that's in some of these services that we really don't understand, there is now that risk that something goes wrong and we don't have visibility. We don't see it coming until after the catastrophe, and the Horizon scandal is an example of that. It emerged even when it was starting to happen. There was still no awareness of it, and it continued over time. So that the need for redress, I think, is important in those circumstances. The challenge for clients, so it could be government or it could be big corporates, is although the fault is somewhere down that supply chain, no one at the post office can put their hands up and go, that's awful, but it's not our fault. It was Fujitsu's. They own that ultimate risk. They've got the reputational risk that will tarnish post office now for years, if not generations. And same's true in other situations. Even though the fault was elsewhere, the risk is still the client. And again, at a board level, at that sort of senior executive level, they need to acknowledge they're never escaping from that risk. Even if they can pin blame on and get retribution, the reputational risk will always be there. When airlines spend a lot of time code sharing, you think you're booking with this brand of airline, and you turn up at the airport, and sometimes you're actually flying with one of their partners. So it may be that you thought you were flying with, say, British Airways. Getting on the flight, it turns out it's American. But in your mind, you booked British Airways. So any flaw in that chain, I'm going to be association with the brand, even though it's the service is delivered by others. And I think that metaphor applies to so much else. So in the public sector, if something goes wrong with a government outsourced IT contract, people still look at the government going, oh, the government's rubbish. There's a technique known as three lines of defense, and it's not perfect. However, it goes a long way to demonstrating that should something go wrong, there's a very powerful defense, which is we had undertaken three lines of defense approach. So first line is you outsource to people who are capable and competent. They're professionals. They've got professional qualifications. They're experienced. And I think the true measure of a profession is these people are members of a professional association with a code of ethics. And I think that's one of the things that keeps getting missed. So are the people we are outsourcing to professional qualified? Not the group who came in as the sales team, but the people who are actually doing the job. So there's a bit of due diligence on, can I go meet your team and just kind of get to know them and their background? Second line of defense is with oversight by a very capable management team, often people who've come up through the ranks, time served, got a wider perspective, probably got experience beyond just the immediacy of the organization that you've outsourced to. And so if something started to go wrong, is there psychological safety in this team that they feel they could share that? Have we provided psychological safety with you folks so that if things are going awry, you don't hide it, you share it? And then third line of defense is an independent group of experts who come and open the lids and have a look around and a rummage in the sewers and the drains to see what's going on, and sort of periodic review of and then come back with an independent assessment on kind of confidence.
Vic Khurana is Vice Chair of the Outsourcing and Managed Services Subcommittee of the IBA Technology Law Committee and a digital and IT partner at Bristow's law firm in London. He assesses the evolution of technology in the context of outsourcing, given scandals such as that involving the post office and the role of regulation.
I think for years, the outsourcing or technology sector was probably maybe even underregulated, but now we're seeing this whole wave of new digital regulation from the AI Act, Data Act, we've had GDPR for a while, other things like product safety laws that apply to software and cybersecurity laws like NIS and the Cyber Resilience Act. There's this whole wave of digital regulation. I kind of refer to it as the alphabet soup. There's so many acronyms now. And they apply to organizations in different ways. They apply to the developers of the technology at the point at which they are developing those tools, but also to the buyers and the, what we call the customers of that, to say, okay, well, if you're going to be ultimately using AI, say, in an HR process, that might be high risk under the AI Act. And if you're using a tool provided by a third party, you've got to make sure that they can explain how that works, because you yourself, as the user of that technology, are going to be directly regulated. So we saw lots of clients and companies who before probably didn't think that much about digital regulation because they didn't think of themselves as a tech business, now really have to think about it. I mean, a lot of that is older legacy technology we're talking about, in say in the post office case, where there was a level of trust put into the system and the technology, which was then relied on to make decisions that impacted people. And I think as we move forward with AI and automation, there's more of a black box and maybe harder to explain and understand what decisions are being made potentially. I think that's putting more emphasis on people to say, look, don't take the technology for granted that it's always right. There is a psychology to this where you see we're reliant on computer systems in our everyday life, and we trust that when we press that button, it's going to have the effect we'll have. These are really complex interlocking webs of systems that can easily go wrong. We can see that. So I think the key will be to be asking questions before taking a business decision based on a technology output. I think we've seen that with Horizon. We see that in other spheres where we see AI potentially going wrong. And I think here regulation has got a role. In some quarters, the EU's been criticized for taking quite a heavy-handed approach to the AI Act. But when you look at the core of it, a lot of the requirements for the higher risk AI it's imposing are about transparency and explainability. I think at the core, a lot of what they're saying is making sure when you build these tools and then operate them, you can explain to someone how that tool came to that decision and why we made an objective decision around it. And then, by the way, all the sector regulators kind of require that of you anyway. If you think about financial services or healthcare, maybe they don't granularly say your technology tools need to do this, but you know, senior stakeholders and execs in those companies need to, you know, we see them in front of parliamentary select committees now, but they need to be able to explain that. And so having actually a little less blind trust, more transparency and management information behind why technology is doing what it's doing, and then deciding to say, look, we're going to take a robust approach to investigation of the root cause analysis of this issue, because the root cause analysis often isn't the people and the end users, but it's the inadvertent way something's been built or operated, maybe with no bad faith or malice involved, but that can be the effect. And I think that's putting more emphasis on organizations, that explainability and transparency, and being aware of the decisions they make based on technology.
Tom Denwood is Chief Digital Officer of New York-based investment company Population Health Partners. He previously spent 17 years in the UK's National Health Service, the NHS, working on major technology change programmes. He outlines the key benefits of outsourcing and examines the pitfalls facing IT outsourcing projects.
Yes, I think there's three main benefits. I think historically, it was all about generating cost savings. Yeah, I think that was the main, you know, outsource a function, outsource a technology function. In my world, I'm a technologist, you know, outsource, it's cheaper and better. Yeah, sometimes that's true, sometimes it's not true. So I think two of the other great benefits of outsourcing is you can deliver capabilities where you don't have them already or where they don't exist. It helps you jump forward quickly and gain some new capabilities which you didn't have, maybe new functions or new technologies, and also additional capacity where needed. So if you're scaling something up, maybe it's a national or a global rollout of a technology project and your team isn't big enough, you can kind of turn on our tap and get some additional capacity. So, and
Right.
then cost savings, capability, and capacity would be the three main drivers. Ultimately, it starts with clear direction. Yeah, whether that's kind of ministerial direction, but there needs to be a very clear vision and purpose. And if that's fragile or not enduring, then really need to spend your time getting that in place first before you start thinking about outsourcing. If that's in place, you need a really capable client team to execute. Because I've seen lots of outsourcing happen where you have a very weak client team, all the knowledge sits outside the organization, and they don't know what they're buying. Yeah, so sec after the kind of clear vision and purpose, it would be a capable client team. I think the third thing would be to think very deeply and very carefully around what services you're actually buying, what you actually need. Yeah, because if you as a client team don't know, and you kind of don't really know what your requirement is or how you want to execute it, then yeah, it's not a good idea to go shopping for something if you don't know what you're buying. Now, you know, sure as eggs are eggs, folks may not know at the outset what they're after. So instead of jumping straight into an outsourcing arrangement, maybe there's the opportunity for some smaller pieces of work to really explore what folks need and what capabilities are needing before then engaging in an outsourcing arrangement. And then once that arrangement's in place, and obviously that'll be done against a clear specification. And in my world as a kind of NHS technology leader, they'd clearly be bidding and following relevant procurement rules. You would end up with a preferred bidder. You might have a technology test as part of that, and then select the bidder and then work with them effectively. And obviously working with them effectively throughout the program is arguably as important as the earlier stages. But I think my key rule out of all of this is if you haven't got the vision and you don't have the trajectory set correctly, you could spend lots of time fixing it downstream. So you've got to get it set up once and get it in the right trajectory to begin with. Otherwise, you're forever trying to basically in a break fix environment. It's broken, you've got to fix it. And the cost and time of the change controls and the other endeavors, kind of, you've got to get it sorted from day one. The vision rolls down into kind of what are the use cases and the user acceptance tests you're going to do on the product. And if you haven't got that kind of almost golden thread from vision through to what folks could be going to be doing on the shop floor, then the testing won't be as effective. But certainly, and particularly for clinical systems, there are national regulations bound into a Health and Social Care Act 2012, I think it is, around clinical safety. There's clinical safety standards which you have to follow before you can put a clinical system into life, as well as all the other good ISO 27001 and 9001 security. So yeah, there's lots of interest in building stuff and getting the technology ready, but often people, well, very significantly underestimate the amount of time required for software testing before live. And that's not just a one-off, it's continually every time you put a new software release into life.